So today I'll be talking about this conjecture presented first by Brown and Hanno in 1986, which claims that any theory of quantum gravity on an ADS3 manifold is a conformal field theory. For people who weren't there in the conformal field theory or the string theory lectures, I'd just like to point out that a conformal field theory is any quantum field theory where your Lagrangian is invariant under rescaling, under scale transformations on the metric. So it's like you can zoom out and zoom in, and the theory essentially just cares about angles rather than distances. And an important application of this conjecture is that you can use it to statistically count the microstates of black holes whose near horizon geometry is ADS3. So you zoom into the horizon. If there's an ADS3 there, you can actually count the number of microstates and use it to sort of exponentiate that to, take the log of that to calculate the entropy. The way it does that is it uses a technique in conformal field theory, which is called Cardy's formula. And so I'll briefly touch on that derivation. And then at the end, I'll talk about what implications this had back in the day when this was done for the information paradox. And depending on the mood of the people, I'll say a word or two about this thing at the end. So I want to start by reminding you of this beautiful formula. Pratik talked about this in detail last time. I think it's still pretty beautiful. And apart from the fact that it brings together the many sectors, so to speak, of theoretical physics, the important thing is the H here and the G. And so it's sort of a union. It's sort of pointing to the fact that you can use black holes. Black holes are the sort of arena where quantum mechanics and general relativity are brought together. And you can this can give you some sort of an insight into a theory of quantum gravity, which will be the holy grail of theoretical physics.
Is it written like this? In Pardon? This fancy way?
I don't know. Okay. I just liked it that way. So, but when Hawking and collaborators came up with this formula in the 1970s, the question immediately arose that what microstates does this correspond to? We're used to a notion of entropy in thermodynamics, where you have a number of microstates, you take a log of that and come up with some entropy. And so the question was, does this correspond to any microstates? Now, there was an immediate hint in this formula, this factor of A. It's not the volume, it's the area. And so it pointed to the fact that this may have something to do with microstates which lie near the horizon of the black hole and not in the causally inaccessible interior. I'll say a word about that in the end as well. And so in 96, Strominger and Wafa came up with a conjecture. Not a conjecture, they came up with a calculation they did for a five-dimensional horizon Nordstrom black hole. And they, using arguments in string theory, they reproduced the formula which was known for entropy by counting the microstates. But a year later, Strominger independently realized that you don't necessarily need to have a string theory to reproduce this formula. Any consistent unitary theory of quantum gravity with some conditions near the horizon is enough to do this calculation just by using some symmetry conditions. And so over the years, our understanding of this calculation using microstates has evolved from five-dimensional black holes done by these guys, the three-dimensional BTZ black hole, which is what I'll talk about in detail today, to eventually four-dimensional Kerr black holes, which are the black holes we observe in the sky. And I'll say a word about this at the end. So back to what I promised earlier, I want to start with this conjecture. And the starting point is you have a three-dimensional theory of gravity coupled to matter. This is the usual Einstein-Hilbert action. We have a cosmological constant here given by minus 1 over L squared. And this is the matter term, which will not be important for the rest of the discussion, but it's just put in there for completion. And this has an ADS3 solution, which is given by this. L, again, is related to the cosmological constant here. And so now, naturally, since we're thinking about a theory of quantum gravity, the natural thing to ask would be, so this is a background metric. Now, the question is, can we think about or talk about fluctuations on this background metric? And so it turns out that because gravity is topological in three dimensions, it's enough to constrain your fluctuations on the boundary. And so you need to come up with some sort of boundary conditions, and that'll sort of define what fluctuations you're looking at in your theory. And now you could have said that there's a whole host of boundary conditions I can come up with, but it's been shown that there's usually only a narrow window in that if you sort of choose your boundary conditions as your metric decaying too fast, then your theory just becomes a trivial theory and you get nothing interesting. And if you keep them too weak, then your generators that you get at the end of the theory they're ill-defined, they blow up, and some, you have some weird behavior. So usually there's this narrow window you need, you have. Sorry. Yeah, sure. So what I mean by that is that it does not have any dynamical degrees of freedom. Basically, it's the same argument. You have same components for the Ricci tensor and the Riemann tensor. And so once you fix that, you know everything about your theory.
What is ASP?
I'll say a word in a minute, about that in a minute. It's basically an asymptotic symmetry group, but I'll talk about it. Yes, Martin.
If you don't have local degrees of freedom, what are the fluctuations of the background metric that you're talking about?
Pardon me, sir?
If you don't have local degrees of freedom, what are the fluctuations around the background metric that you're talking about?
No, so essentially what I mean is that if you, in order to have consistency in your theory, all you need to know is how the fluctuations behave asymptotically. Does that?
Yeah. So, I mean, by fluctuations, we don't mean like gravity form, right?
So far, this is just classical.
I mean,
No. So I'm looking at how I can have perturbations about background metric and how they will behave asymptotically. So far, that's. So it turns out that one choice of these boundary conditions turns out to be this. This was calculated a while ago for a certain class of black holes, and it's more or less generic. I mean, it's one choice that you know works, and it works for a certain class of black holes, which we'll be talking about. It gives you like well-defined generators and all of that stuff in unitary theory. And so it's like you have these usual components which were in your background metric, and the way they decay at infinity is given like in this way. And so, yeah, I know it's at the moment it seems like it's just popped out of a hat, but I think there's a lot of guesswork involved in this particular calculation. They came up with this a while ago, and it's been shown to work. And you'll have to take my word on that for now. So now that we know the way the fluctuations behave, the next question to ask would be, do we know the symmetries of this metric? I mean, we had some background metric. We know the isometries of that metric. But now that we've put in these fluctuations, do we know what isometries we have now? Is it a larger group? Is it a smaller group? Are there any other symmetries that we have?
So is this a black hole metric?
These are the components of, not a black hole metric yet. This is just the ADS space, and these are the fluctuations on the boundary. But it's related to one. So when you're talking about the notion of symmetries in this case, there are two important definitions I want to put forward before I move on and talk about the asymptotic symmetry group. One of them is allowed diffeomorphisms. So you chose some boundary conditions, and your allowed diffeomorphisms are variations that give you some metric where the variations lie in some set where you, so you came up with like the decay behavior order r to the minus 4 and such stuff like that. And so an allowed diffeomorphism will be something where the variation lies in that set of allowed metrics. And a trivial diffeomorphism would be that when you calculate the corresponding charge on the boundary, it gives you a trivial charge. So far, this is just definitions. But the important thing is that you define a group where you mod out your trivial diffeomorphisms from your allowed diffeomorphisms. And this group is what Jens asked about earlier. It's called the asymptotic symmetry group. And an important thing to keep in mind for the moment is that so it does not have to be, first of all, your asymptotic symmetry group does not exactly have to be the isometry group of the space you started with. So for example, in ADS3, you'd naively expect that since your asymptotic symmetry group is SO2, 2, it does not have to be your asymptotic symmetry group as well, right?
What about Minkowski space?
Pardon? So in Minkowski space, when you have, so for example, it's not always the Poincaré group on the boundary. If you look at your null infinity, you get this infinite dimensional group, the BMS group. So the point I'm trying to make is that it does not have to be a isometry group. And just to clarify what I meant here is that about with allowed diffeomorphisms is that, let's say you have some four-dimensional Minkowski space, and you choose your boundary conditions to be, let's say, 1/r corrections of the boundary, then a diffeomorphism which gives you some variation like r^16 will obviously not be allowed because it's not in the initial allowed subset that you define, in the set that you define.
Metric the same is fine, right? So I mean, when you say the allowed diffeomorphism. So
yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, so it can be greater than isometry.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what it is in this case. So in this particular case, the allowed diffeomorphisms that you get are defined by these generators. You have diffeomorphism in time, phi, and r to your original coordinates. The partial derivatives are defined as linear combinations of the partial derivative with respect to time and phi. And the t pluses and t minuses that you saw on the previous slide were bases labeled by e to the I n t over l plus phi and the conjugate. And so what you do is that, so now let's sort of take a step back and think about what we're doing. We had a background solution. We had a background metric. We considered fluctuations about it near the boundary. And we're trying to find out what symmetries we have in our theory. And so we come up with some diffeomorphisms, which are allowed diffeomorphisms in our theory. And now this is a local symmetry. It's not a global symmetry. So we can't apply the usual Noether's procedure. But there is a well-defined procedure that exists for this. And so we use it to calculate the conserved charges. Once we calculate the conserved charges, because this is a constraint system, we will not have Poisson brackets. We'll have something which is called Dirac brackets because we have constraints. And so the next step would be to sort of take those Dirac brackets and move them into commutators. And the relationship that we find for the commutators is given in this way. Just to clarify, these are not the Lorentz modes that we studied in CFT. These are just related to the conserved charges up to some constants. And, I mean, it's labeled that way. And so what we see here is that we get a Virasoro algebra, where this term, if you remember, corresponds to C over 12. And so we read off here that this gives you, that this Virasoro algebra corresponds to a theory with a with a central charge given by 3L over 2G.
From that it is a CFT, or okay. But then I'm still kind of confused because you have this cosmological constant, which has like an internal length scale, which I mean, like obviously is the thing that you're that gives your anomaly. But I don't know.
So
like, the action does not look conformally invariant to me.
Yeah, I see your point, and I just like to emphasize that this is really a conjecture still. Some more evidence was provided in this case by people who sort of you can actually compute quantum correlators on both sides, and people showed that the correlators using the black hole side and using the CFT side, they turn out to be the same. So that's more evidence in that direction. It's still pretty much a conjecture though.
Okay. Sorry, just as a comment to this, the gravitational constant in 2+1 dimensions doesn't so also has a dimension of a length squared, I think. So in principle, you could use this to argue that you can come up with some dimensionless thing here.
Yeah.
So the Planck mass also in 2+1 dimensions doesn't include h bar, so which is the justification why you could do this.
Right.
So you wouldn't use any quantum, quantum theory.
Yeah. But I mean, you can take your pick. People still call it a conjecture, though. So we have Dirac brackets, and then when you quantize the theory, you just take those Dirac brackets to 1 over iota h bar commutators, and so these are commutators. And so yeah, so as Martin pointed out, this points to the conjecture that quantum gravity on ADS 3 is a conformal field theory with this particular central charge, and your CFT is defined on your boundary, which is given by Yeah, so it's a spatial boundary, so you have time and phi, so it's like a cylinder. Your CFT is living on that. So now that we've understood that we can think of a theory of quantum gravity on ADS3 as a conformal field theory, let's try and apply it to the initial claim that you could count the number. That you can count the number of microstates using this formalism. And so what you do is you consider a particular black hole, which is called the BTZ black hole. It's a solution to 2+1 dimensional gravity with a negative cosmological constant. It's very, very similar to the ADS3 metric we wrote down initially. If you pick mass to be -1/8g, it's exactly the same. And so you write down this metric for a black hole. You calculate the entropy just by looking at a particular radius and fixing the time and calculating this part. And you come up with this thing. And I've just put this equation here in for just to remind you that if I plug in the value of central charge, I calculated here, it's this thing. So the entropy given in terms of the central charge is this.
Sorry, I think I was wrong. It's half an hour, right? So,
do I start over again? Start over. So this is the entropy of the black hole given in terms of the central charge and the energy. Sorry, the energy here is equal to the mass. It's the ADM energy in this case.
That's a good point.
But then it wouldn't make sense to be negative.
Okay, so you have Kolmar energy.
Well, it's some kind of subtracted thing, so it's kind of that we all have to think.
Okay, so the entropy is given in terms of central charge this way, and so I have 15 minutes, right? Yeah, I can do this. So now we know what the entropy is from this black hole calculation. Now let's see if we can reproduce this using what the operators we set up for the CFT. And to do this, we need something which is called Cardy's formula. This will be a slight diversion from what I'm doing, but you'll see why I'm doing it at the end. And so what Cardy's formula says is that if you have any 2D conformal field theory on a torus in the low temperature limit, as beta goes to infinity, your partition function is given by that. And we saw in the string theory course that your vacuum energy on a torus or a cylinder is given in terms of the central charge as this. And so you plug this in and you get the low temperature behavior of the partition function. But then the trick is, the smart trick here, is that because you're in Euclidean space-time, you can just choose to call the space direction time and the time direction space. And so you switch them. And because you're in a conformal field theory, you can always choose to rescale your coordinates this way. And now, so because in order now to be able to compare it with your initial theory, you want your spatial coordinate to be periodic in 2 pi again. And so you do this rescaling, and you redefine these coordinates, sigma and tau prime, and you plug it back in. And so what you get is your partition function in the low temperature regime and in the high temperature regime is related this way. But this is some new quantity I've defined as beta prime. This is an example of what you call modular invariance in a conformal field theory. And so I plug this value for beta prime back in. And what I get is now that as beta prime goes to 0, the partition function scales this way. And so now notice that this is the high temperature behavior of your conformal field theory. And so you apply the usual formulas for entropy and free energy, and this is what you get. And so plugging the formula for energy back in here, the entropy is given this way. Yeah. So yeah, so basically the essential result to notice here is that the calculation from your black hole side of the entropy, and by using the fact that it's a CFT, you apply the formula for a CFT and you get the same entropy. And so this is one example of how you can use a conformal field theory to actually, you know, using microstates, come up with a formula for the entropy. So I'll move on to the discussion for now, and if I have time, I'll come back to this short version at the end. So now what we do after this is that this was in 3 dimensions. This sort of notion of using a BTZ black hole, something which has a near horizon ADS3, in some sense it generalizes or it sort of builds up into 4 dimensions into what is called a Kerr CFT correspondence, where you look for quotients of ADS3 near near horizon limit, and then you use this correspondence with CFT in a 2-dimensional CFT to calculate the entropy. There is a particular restriction that comes up in that case, is that you can do it for extremal Kerr black holes where the angular momentum and the mass are related in this way. It's been shown to work to some orders, I believe, for non-extremal black holes as well. But these are the ones we understand best at the moment. And the power of the Kerr CFT correspondence is in the fact that it allows you to analytically study phenomena which were previously, you know, we could study numerically and, you know, with some approximations. For example, emission of jets from Kerr black holes and stuff. And the GRS 1915 plus 105 is a black hole in the sky. It's almost extremal, 98% extremal, and it's been shown that you can do some calculations using CFT for it. And that's pretty much it. And plus, the thing I wanted to say is, this may be a little outdated now in the light of the recent work that has been done by Hawking and collaborators, but this, when this work was initially done, the fact that you could use near horizon microstates to come up with the entropy, that sort of reinforced the belief that your entropy lies near the horizon of the black hole and not in the causally inaccessible interior. And so maybe there's some way in which the information is not lost, it still resides near the boundary. Is that a question?
Yes, like when you say like it's stored near the boundary, it's in these modes which decay away from the boundary, right?
So what I'm saying is that if you have, for example, in this particular case, when you zoom into your horizon, that's where you recover an ADS3 or quotients of ADS3 in four dimensions. And so it's the near horizon geometry to which you can apply a conformal field theory in order to study your, to calculate your entropy.
But if I just look at a black hole, where is the information
stored? Pardon, sorry?
If I just look at a black hole, where is the information stored? Like, in what is the information?
Near the boundary.
Yes, how? Yeah, okay.
Oh, how?
Yeah.
I think this, so far, this just points to the fact that it can be stored near the boundary and you can recover the entropy near the boundary. Exactly how it's stored, I don't think they sort of resolved it at this stage. So just at the end, I'd like to quickly point to something a little more specific if you talk about in terms of quantum gravity, which it's a derivation that uses string theory. But all I want to say for the moment is that you can, for a particular class of black holes, you can do a similar calculation using string theory to calculate the entropy by counting the microstates. And so this particular example is the one I talked about at the start, the one done by Schrödinger and Wafa in 96. And so what they did was they took a particular string theory, they took a low energy limit of that supersymmetric string theory, and when you come up with this, it gives you this action. And when you calculate the metric, you dimensionally reduce to five dimensions. What I mean by that is something we did in the gravitational physics course, the Kaluza-Klein compactification, where you have these dimensions rolled up as tiny circles. And so you express everything in terms of your, let's say, five dimensions, and then you derive the five-dimensional metric from it. And this is similar to the Schwarzschild string that we found over there. That's how it arises in string theory. And then you calculate the entropy, where these constants are just some parameters in your theory for now. And using the fact that you have, so notice that this H, this is the field strength corresponding to a two form, and the d-brains you'll have in your theory. Maybe I'm going too fast, maybe. So you have a two form in your theory. Now it can couple to a D2 brain and its magnetic dual, which is a D5 brain. And so it turns out that this metric can also be produced in a string theory just if you take the extra five dimensions and wrap D brains around them. So you wrap a D1 brain along one of them and the D5 brain along the other five directions. And if you calculate the number of ways in which you can attach open strings between them, it gives you the exact same formula as you get from calculating the entropy from the usual method, just by from the one we calculated in the Schwarzschild string case. And so it's one way in which string theory sort of allows you to calculate this black hole entropy using these microstates. And so, but this was for a five-dimensional black hole. Now you could say that, yeah, what good is a five-dimensional black hole in this case? But more recently, it was shown that for a four-dimensional black hole, which has charge, Ogori, Schrödinger, and Wafa came up with this conjecture which said that the black hole partition function is related to the partition function of a topological field theory, a topological string theory in this case, and you can calculate the partition function here, and to leading order, it gives you the Hawking-Bekenstein entropy, and you have quantum corrections to it. And so this is one case where you can actually use string theory to come up with some sort of a prediction. And so it remains to be seen whether or not it's justified in the future. That's it. Most part of this talk was borrowed from the first reference. And yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Profound questions.
Yes.
Yeah, so you, let's see if I understood this correctly, this part in the middle. You say you have ADS3 and consider some kind of fluctuations on this. And then people came up with the ADS-CFT correspondence to relate these fluctuations in the bulk with some kind of thermalization procedure on the boundary CFT.
This isn't the ADS-CFT correspondence so far, but I haven't talked about it yet.
Okay,
but
let's call it whatever you want.
Okay,
but I mean, so we have some kind of fluctuations that's decay, and on the boundary you do something with the temperature. You consider the T going to zero limit.
No, so the
whole argument with that temperature was just, so if you just forget about everything else, you just take a conformal field theory and you try and calculate the entropy as for high temperature, That was just to come up with some sort of a formula for the entropy for any CFT. The argument whether or not it corresponds to an ADS3 was independent. That was something different at the start. And so I just put that in to sort of give you how it matches with the entropy in that case.
I mean, the current formula is only done for certain range, right?
Yeah, it's for high temperatures.
So,
and in this particular case, it boils down to you can show that it's valid when your temperature is higher than your central charge. And so for especially for Kerr black holes and for some other class of black holes, that assumption is valid, and so you can apply that formula. Temperature scales with mass. Sorry, what does that mean?
Because like would this then be like better for heavy black holes as an approximation for very tiny black holes? Because if it's like the same kind of scale that you have.
Yeah. So I think the only bound you have at the moment is that your angular momentum is related to the mass in some way. So the only restriction you have is angular momentum being close to your mass. Other than that, whether the mass is large or small, I don't know. I haven't come across anything in that regard.
But of course, the extreme of black hole is below temperature regime, right?
Uh-huh.
So your formula must be valid for small temperatures, not for. So you're sending beta to infinity, not T, right? Or,
mm-hmm.
Is that what you have in your formula? So if you look at your formula.
You mean for Cardi's entropy?
Yeah. So when you're taking the T equals to. Oh, okay, so I'm already taking large them. So then I don't know how you can apply this to extreme of black hole, which has zero temperature.
Ah, no, I see your point. So it has zero Hawking temperature, but when you take the extremal limit, it's shown in this paper I cited at the end that if you take the limit, so you have something in the numerator and something in the denominator, and you're taking both of them to zero. If you take the limit carefully, you come up with some term which is non-zero to first to some leading order, and that gives you some sort of effective temperature in that case.
Any other questions? So when you write down the fluctuation of your boundary decay, those are the exact how the boundary has to decay. It can't be decaying faster or slower than.
It has to decay within that bound. I mean, so if I have a term which has order r to the minus 4, it can decay faster than that, but not slower than that.
Is there anything typical that we know? For example, in two dimensions, two spatial dimensions, people introduce Yukawa couplings and these kind of things, where like some exponential times 1 over r, you know, that it makes it decay really fast. Does that fall in this category?
You mean to sort of help you motivate the boundary conditions? See how they.
Perturbation, for example, that decays with some mass scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that could work, but the thing is, like, you have consistency checks on this. You have to see whether or not it gives you well-defined generators and whether or not your theory turns out to be trivial or something of that sort. So it'll have to satisfy those checks if it is valid.
And the question was already here, but what is the source of these perturbations?
No, so basically you're studying fluctuations about your classical solution, right? That's why you're calling it a quantum theory.
But it can't be gravitational perturbations because it's a topological theory. You have no propagating degrees of freedom, right?
Uh-huh.
So you have to put some scalar field or something?
That's a good point. So my understanding of this was if you have some background theory, which is a classical solution, if you go to a quantum theory, you need to study fluctuations about it. I don't know how they arise in this case, but when they arise, you can sort of formulate it in terms of a CFT, depending on, it could be a scalar field or something of that sort.
So I feel like these are not like radiative modes, but these are like modes which just, because of the boundary conditions that you take, are evanescent modes in that sense, right? So then it's like, it's in these evanescent modes that you encode this information. I think that's kind of what's happening in
there.
I think it's good to continue the discussion afterwards, during dinner maybe. So let's thank you, Bertie.
Hello, everyone. By the way, I'm Sopet. Today, my talk is about a part of my winter school project supervised by Dr. Hama Aliosa. And it is about a simple model which will demonstrate us that the typicality of the entanglement. By this, it means that if we start our system, you know, a closed system with a state and then let it time evolve, most of the time, when you look at it after a while, you will see that the state become highly entangled. So we will see the result, but keep in mind, it's just a simple model. So the outline of the talk would be the definition of the model, the setup, and then I'm going to compute the entanglement entropy, and then we will go through the discussion. So this is the model. So let's start with our system, S, which is a closed system, which is a system of the multi-particles. And this system will be defined on a graph, gamma, which has a set of vertices V and set of edges E. And our particles live on the vertex of our graph. And the set of the edges will define the local structure, will define some sort of the sense of distance. So if it is, when we look at the system S and then we look at the a localized region, we get the sense of locality. So our total Hilbert space is the H total, which is the tensor product of the Hilbert space for each particle. And we assume that to be C to the power D. So the rest of the talk will be this. This is the timeline of the rest of the talk. We start with a pure system S, and then we perform the unitary time evolution. And this unitary time evolution capture the time evolution induced by the local Hamiltonian. So it is local in the sense that these unitary belong to the linear operator space acting on the Hilbert space of X, where X is a localized region in our system. So, but we are not interested on one particular Hamiltonian. We are interested in many Hamiltonians. So we are going to do the statistical average on this local unitary time evolution. So with that, we will arrive at our average state. And then we will look at the purity of the reduced state of our average state. And we will use this purity to tell whether the average state is entangled or not. So we know already that if the purity of the reduced state is very small, then the state in the total Hilbert space will be highly entangled. If the purity is really large, then the state in the total Hilbert space will be not so entangled. So this is the average that we are going to take. So we start with the density matrix at time t equals 0, and then we perform the local unitary operation on it, both sides. And then we do the average. But then when we do the average, we also need to take care of this localized region in our system. So we also need a probability distribution to take care when we do the average. We do the same thing for k steps. So this is the density matrix after k time, which is the same procedure acting on the density matrix at time k minus 1. So then we will compute the purity of this density matrix.
Okay.
Yes. You take like all possible x. Yeah.
Then why do you follow the time steps? Because wouldn't the unitary evolution of the kth time step sort of just get chopped into the unitary time step evolution for k minus 1? Does that make sense?
You mean that if we do the randomizing over the x, it will take care of everything already?
And 1 to 2 would be the same as averaging over times this 1 to 2.
I think the main point of doing this is because we are going to take care of all possible local Hamiltonian.
It's not the same unitary.
It's
Sorry?
It's not the same unit tree, right?
It's averaging.
It's average. Or
so
unitaries.
Is, it's E represent edges.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. It should be the subset of V. Of the subsystem S. Sorry, not V, S. So X is represent the localized region, right? X represent the localized region in the subsystem, in the whole system S.
What is
it's a typo, sorry. It should be should be this. Sorry.
So local, so if you keep apply, then you can propagate, right? Because they're just local.
Yeah.
Then eventually you can sort of create
what I mean
global.
Is that you're averaging over all unitaries generated by all Hamiltonians.
But they're all local.
They're all local.
Yeah, yeah, so if you keep apply, then probably you'll get a global impact.
But unitaries only act on X anyway.
So the unitary will be this, right? Exponent of I times H, T. So let's say T equal 1, then you have H. So you want to do all possible this, so you will X. So we do all possible this, it's somehow equivalent to doing all possible this one. Yes?
So when you say you have local evolutions, you mean like next nearest neighbors?
Yeah, it's not like that. We can do it later. Later we will do that. But now we are considering the general case where we can do like say this part. And then the next one we do this part. We will take care of all possible combination, right? This or this or this,
is
and so
criteria
on.
Which says like you can't take S at once, or like all of S at once, or
because in the physical system the Hamiltonian is always local, right?
Sure. So
yeah.
Like how, like when you implement the locality stuff, like how do you make sure that you don't do like update all S at the same time? That's.
Oh, and later on, we will not consider all the possible and thing, and yeah. And we will only consider like a small part of it, yeah. Sorry, it's not so clear at this point. Did I finish this? Yeah, so this is the purity of our system. It's like after we do first step, like k after k equal to 1, then we get this reduced density matrix that we trace out the rest of the A in from our density matrix at time t equal 1, and then we take the average of this. So, but then we will use a simple trick called replica trick. Well, we have this. We want to compute the trace of row square. Then we do the 2 tensor copy of this row is a row A tensor itself, but to avoid confusion, I put a prime in there. But to make this an identity, we need to use a flip swapping operator. This is an identity which can be proved by considering the density matrix in a basis where it is all diagonal. So from this is an identity, and then from this it's like we are looking at the whole, the total density matrix, and with the swapping operator given by this. So we just ignore it, we just do nothing on the system B, while we don't care about it. So with this, we will use the definition of the average, which is nothing else but the trace over the, this probability X and the integration over this density matrix at time zero, putting the evolution on both sides, but this time the evolution becomes the tensor square. But then we can move it to this side to consider the Heisenberg picture, which becomes this. And we will need to calculate this part, but now we need to, assume that to make the calculation simple, we need to assume that X now is just a single edge. So X is a localized region inside the S, but it's composed of only two particles which are connected by the edge. So with that, and I'm calling this quantity Rxf. So we have two possibility, actually three. So this is our system S, and this is the system subsystem A. So if X lies entirely outside the system A, or X lies entirely inside the system A, then this operator F flipping FAA prime will commute with this UX, and then we'll move inside, become identity, and this one is the Haar measure of the unitary operator, a unitary representation. It will become one, and this result is just the operator swapping the, swapping the qubit, because when we do the replica trick, we have the system A and A prime, and then we will swap the qubit with the corresponding one. I think it's in this one. So this is the replicated system. We have A and A prime. And then after we add this operator on, we just swap this qubit. So this is the case where this thing lies entirely inside outside, but it will be complicated when it becomes like this. So this is the case. So a thing that can help us to look at this calculation is to rewrite the swapping operator FAA prime in terms of a tensor product. So we swap the element inside the AA prime one by one in this sense. And then for those particles which live outside, which live in A, but I mean in this region, it has nothing to do with our X. So they will just commute through the unitary operator. So it will become this part. But then the FAA prime, where A prime is this one, it lies inside the A and also belongs to our X. So it will be stuck in that part. And we will use the Sker lemma to write this down. This average can be written as the linear combination of the projector of this representation. So in this representation, U tensor U, it has two projector. One project into the symmetric invariant subspace, while the other one is a anti-symmetric invariant subspace. Because U tensor U, if we start with an anti-symmetric space, we will stay in there. If we started with the anti-symmetric state, we also stay in there. So we have two invariant subspace. And the coefficient can be taken as God given at this point. And this pi plus can be expressed in terms of this, which we will anti-symmetrize or symmetrize the state. So, and putting this this definition into this trace, we can see one can prove that this part will be zero from this. The minus part will trace of this, equal trace of this, but then minus part will just cancel out. So then we will have only the first term. So with that first term, this is the first term, which is the reminiscence of the pi plus. And then it acts on the thing that we, you know, kind of move outside the unitary operator. And this is the prefactor. And we can see that this is a doing nothing on this. So it becomes itself. This one is it's like swapping everything inside A except the small a. But now we also swap A. So become doing a swapping everything inside A, but we also do the swapping on B. So now it becomes swapping everything in A plus the B. So this is the result. and then we plug it back to our average purity. And this is the part when, like, if the x lies inside on the boundary of A, then we get this expression where we have this alpha, and this part become this part. And if it lies entirely in A or entirely outside A, it will become just this with itself. Nothing happened. But then we have the probability. So one can see that the boundary now become this one. The boundary is unchanged. It's still A. But this one, the boundary become X excluding. So it's become this. And the other one become this, which is this. So we can see that if we use the Heisenberg picture, the operator now change. The boundary of the region we are acting on is changing. So we can regard it as the evolution of the boundary instead of the state. And if we consider the single edge, like we pick the x randomly from our system S, then we will get that this, the probability of picking x which lie on the boundary is Q, which is nothing else but the dimension of the boundary divided by the total number of the edge. And 1 minus Q if we don't get that. And if we assume that the start row naught is just a completely product state, then we get the trace of this times this equal to 1. Then we get 2 alpha times Q and 1 minus Q. Oh, okay. Now we make one more assumption that this number is very large compared to, I mean, the number of the time is very small compared to this number. Then we can assume that after the evolution, this one doesn't change much and it remains almost the same. So after k step, and under this assumption, we get this. It's just that formula to the power k. And then we can compute the entanglement entropy, which in this case, I'm going to use the Reni entropy, which is defined as the minus of log of the purity. So, but this minus log function is a convex, so the average of the function is greater or equal than the function of the average. So then we can use this formula just now, plug it in, and then we see it is approximately equal to the area of the boundary. So we get somehow the lower bound of this entropy is related to the area law. And the result of our model so far is that it has the boundary, the lower bound related to the area. And if one compute the standard deviation of our statistical average, we see that this is suppressed by square root of the boundary. If the boundary is very large, then the average value is where it's like a, it doesn't fluctuate much. So we can safely say that the entropy is obeying the boundary, the area law. Yes?
E is the total number of edges in the system.
I'm sorry?
E is the total number of edges in the system.
Yes.
Okay, so how does the entanglement entropy relate to, like, why should it know with these local Hamiltonians that there is like this, what's the global number of edges? Like, where does it come from?
The global number of edges?
Yeah.
You can define it because we need to define the graph, right? Mm-hmm. Probably we can take the nearest neighbor and then you just connecting them with the edges and come up with the graph. Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Yeah.
How do you calculate
variance?
Actually, I'm not
sure. I'm just taking this one for granted. But should it be a mine? Okay, we can use the normal formula probably, but I just took this one for granted. Probably it's not the real expression for this. Like S minus S bar squared, and then do the average, and then square root, probably. So we can, because this is just a approximation, because we need to approximate to get this part. We assume that the boundary is very large compared to the K, so that we can get this part. But we can get it exactly in the one-dimensional system, which is a linear chain. So our graph now is converted into the, this is the particle connected by a link. So it's a linear chain. And the subsystem A is defined by this LA, which will count the number of the particle in it. And the rest is subsystem B. And so the purity, the average purity at the time K going to infinity is given by this expression. But for large L, so we are considering this very, very small LA, and then we can calculate it to be this. So this is the purity of this state. So the purity of this state is exactly this one. So we might be able to tell that the average state that we get is completely mixed. So the average state that we get is completely mixed. When we look at the bigger Hilbert space, we can tell that it is highly entangled. So now we can see that in average, the state that we pick from our Hilbert space is highly entangled. So in conclusion, what we have done is that we start with a state and then let it time evolve, but we don't care about the Hamiltonian, so we average all over the possible Hamiltonian, and then we get a average state which has the average entropy obeying the area law, you know, the upper, the lower bound obeying the area law. And then we use it to apply to the one-dimensional linear chain, and we get the average reduced state, the one that I just showed, is where it's very close to the completely mixed state. So it means that the entanglement, the entropy, the total state is very entangled. So, oh, I forget one thing is, and this will show how close the average state to the completely mixed state, which is suppressed by this dimension L to the B, because when LA is very large and LB is very small, then LB is very large, and this number will go to zero. So, thank you. Yes.
Nobody's asking. So you're saying that your final reduced state is almost always going to be maximally mixed.
Yes.
Does that mean if I look at the subsystem of most systems, they'll look very, very hot?
Yes, because the way we are doing it, we do not restrict the conservation of energy, so I think we will get, I mean, everything is the same, then it's equivalent to, you know, high, very high temperature. Yeah.
What about the tensor network people who sort of rely on the area law being an upper bound for entropy?
Entropy.
This talk sort of destroys all their hopes.
It's just a total model. So we simplify a lot of things. So yeah, probably. I don't know.
Thanks for
picking it. Thank you.
So we are going to talk about the notion of particles in the beginning, because it turns out that in quantum field theory, this notion is not so clear. It's not only about the fact that the things that we call particles are not necessarily localized in space. It also has to do with the fact that different observers might have a different notion of what vacuum is and how many particles are around. So the Andrew effect has to do with the fact that a non-inertial observer will detect some particles, and in the case that he is a constantly accelerated observer, we will see that these excitations will follow a thermal probability distribution. So it will be quite equivalent with the scenario in which we have a thermal bath in an inertial frame. So we will start reviewing the scalar Klein-Gordon field solution and talk about modes, how we mean, how do we think of the solution in terms of the modes. We will briefly discuss the Lorentz invariance of fog space, which means that inertial observers mostly agree about these things. So yeah, then we will see what generally happens, and that we generally have something called Bogoliubov transformations of the field modes. And then we will talk about constantly accelerated observers, and we will see what they see and how they can perceive some kind of temperature. In the end, we will discuss detectors, because this is something that kind of helps in rescuing the notion of particle in the context of quantum field theory. So the first couple of slides are like some reviewing of things that we know, but just try to be suspicious about what we mean with vacuum or particles, because the whole effect has to do with this subtlety. So we have this Klein-Gordon Lagrangian, and this is the equations of motion. And our problem is to solve this problem, to solve these equations, given imposing that this holds, where P is the conjugate momentum of the field. This is the second quantization condition. So how we usually solve the problem is that so we have a solution of this form. It is Hermitian, and we can see that if this is a plane wave with this dispersion relation, the Klein-Gordon equation will be satisfied. And if the operators that appear there satisfy this commutation relationship, this part of the problem is also solved, because this will be also satisfied. The thing is to interpret in terms of harmonic oscillators. We would like to have a Kronecker delta there. So what we do is that we usually put our quantum field theories in a box, and we can think of these operators appearing in our solution as obeying the harmonic oscillator algebra we are familiar with. So our solution have the structure. This is what we call the modes, the k modes of the field, and this is the creation and annihilation operators. So let's construct our fog space. We have this vacuum, which is defined like this. It has to be annihilated by all of them. We can construct this one particle subspaces. And let's just make sure, what do I mean by one particle in this context? What I mean is that given this Lagrangian, the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian, if we do the Legendre transformation and then the Fourier transformation and take this Hamiltonian in terms of the case, we can see that this is what we get, where its Hamiltonian gives a spectrum, which is the usual spectrum of harmonic oscillator. I'm just trying to be super careful with what we mean by that, because the whole point is that since every excitation of each of the harmonic oscillators carries this energy, we can think of this dispersion relationship in terms of this, which is the usual relationship for a particle with mass m and momentum p equals kappa. So please notice that since we are talking about particle with particular momentum, this is already not localized at all. It's just some plane wave solution with specific k. So we move on with our construction of the Fock space, and we have this basis, which is interpreted of numbers of particle in each k oscillator. Vacuum means all oscillators in the ground state. This satisfies the definition we gave before. And we can define the usual particle number operator. And we have to keep in mind that this is what this F here indicates, that the notion of the vacuum, and also there, both the notion of the vacuum of our field and the how many particles operator we have around depends on the choice of F modes and operators that appear both in the solution of the simple Klein Gordon Lagrangian. So let's discuss the Lorentz invariance of this Fock space and see that nothing too weird happens for inertial observers. The thing is that this is our solution again. This is just the mode written explicitly, this Fk before. This is like this plane wave satisfying that. I'm just rewriting in terms of four vector languages, language. And I want to emphasize that this k over there is just, at this level, it's just some dummy variable. We just add, because the equations are linear, so we just add through that because each of these satisfy that. But we have to, even though this can be interpreted as some kind of momentum, and we can introduce some zero component to be this omega, which satisfies the dispersion relationship, we still don't really know how this transforms under Lorentz transformation to check that the whole structure of Fock space is preserved. So what we can do carefully is just, since we're talking about the scalar field, we can impose that because it's a scalar field. And where x and x tilde are related with a Lorentz transformation. And we can see, if we do it explicitly, that if these coordinates are related with a Lorentz transformation, we can also relate this k. And sorry, it's not clear what I mean by p. So what I mean by p is that this here can be rewritten as with tilde here. And instead of adding over k, we can add over another dummy variable, which could be p. And we can see that if we relate the two dummies variable with a Lorentz transformation, as our coordinates do, we simply get that result. Which result just indicates that for inertial observers connected with a Lorentz transformation, they just see same particles with boosted momentum, because the creation operator is just the other creation operator with boosted k, and the same for the annihilation operator. So, yeah, some strange things going on. Okay, so generally speaking, we could have made another choice. And that's also very common when we have gravitational backgrounds and not just flat space-time. It's really, you can really see more easily that the plane wave solutions are not the solutions, and there are strange things you can do in terms of modes and operators. So, but the thing is that if we had this, instead of this kind of solution, another solution with G modes and beta, creation and annihilation operators, we would define another vacuum in terms of the G modes being annihilated by all the beta operators, annihilation operators, and we would have another number operator in terms of the beta operators. So we can see that both notions of vacuum and particles would be quite different, and generally, if we want to relate the old modes F with the new modes G, they are generally related through the Bogoliubov transformations. So these transformations are linear. Someone would wonder why are they that simple. The thing is that remember that those operators either we can write this in terms of operators. I mean, it's the same transformation in terms of operators. So both A's and betas have to obey the harmonic oscillator commutation relationship. So this is why this Bogoliubov transformation seems that simple. It's just linear transformations that preserve that form. And so if we do so, we can get that result, which is that this number operator, defined in terms of the Vita creation and annihilation operators, this mean value in the vacuum of the F observer, in the sense that he has a solution in terms of the F modes, is actually non-zero, generally speaking. It is non-zero because if you have this Vita being non-zero, you can actually see that this is exactly this Vita thing, this Vita coefficient here is exactly what does the mixing, in the sense that this annihilation operator is not anymore just some combination of new annihilation operators, but we still have this kind of mixing between annihilation and creation. So we can infer that something strange will happen with the mean value of number of particles, which is which makes this generally non-zero. So in the vacuum of the F observer, the G observer generally perceives particles. So if we focus on a Riddler observer, where we have this special structure of its coordinate system, we can generally define this observer's state by tracing out the modes of the field that he doesn't have access to, in some sense. And we end up with some kind of state with some coefficients here related to alpha, which is the acceleration, the constant acceleration of the Riddler observer. So this is a thermal state in the sense that if you calculate this mean value again, in terms of trace rho number of particles here, you take this distribution, which by analogy with the Bose-Einstein distribution will give you this, you can identify this temperature. So another probably more convincing way to see that could be like through our statistical mechanics second tutorial, where what we did was actually that we had some entropy given when we have some particular state rho, we can calculate the entropy, and varying that and imposing that this should be equal to the temperature times delta Q, we were able to associate Lagrange multipliers that we had there with the temperature and take this Vita of the Boltzmann distribution. The same way here, if we just plug in this state that we take due to the special geometry of the Riddler observer over here, we can identify these constants that are related to the acceleration of the observer. We can identify them and find the relationship of between temperature and acceleration of the observer. So that's another way to see that a Riddler observer would really see this kind of thermal distribution of the particles in the sense of mode field mode excitations. So let's discuss how this notion of particles could be a little bit, let's see what a detector would do and how would we use detector in the sense of a first quantized system coupled to our field, like an atom. You can just take some atom coupled to the field. And we could take the same result. And what we would mean by particles then would be like whatever the detector detects, in the sense that when the detector as an atom, a two-level atom or whatever, will be excited, you can somehow say that since we have an excitation of our first quantized system, which is an atom, this is what could, in a more concrete way, could mean that you have some particle detection in that sense. So how do we couple our first quantized system with a field? This is done throughout some Hamiltonian like this. This is some operator related to the Hilbert space of the atom, let's say, the first quantized system. And this is our field. Um, our field throughout the points that consist the trajectory of the detector in some inertial frame. So you are some inertial observer and you have some detector, some atom, some first quantized system traveling in your inertial frame. And if you plug in this trajectory in here, you can somehow define some interaction between your observer. This could be the Hamiltonian of the atom, let's say, and this could be something like the charge of the atom of the of some particle traveling, the electron of the atom, let's say here. So having that and calculating things in the interaction picture, we can say that the state of the whole system, which is the detector, the atom, plus the field, evolves with this. Yeah, I should have a time ordering here. Yeah. So, I'm sorry, there is one iota missing there. You can actually expand this exponential and doing an approximation that this coupling constant between the atom and the field is small, we just take, we will just keep this part. We will neglect that. And we will calculate the probability of the detector being excited from its ground state to another state, while the field goes from its vacuum state to the one mode excitation state in terms of the inertial observer. So this is the probability we care about. This is the whole system at time t. This is the state of the system at time t, and this is the final state of the detector and the field. So this seems a little bit messy. We want to calculate the probability amplitude at infinite time. And if we do so, so things are being paired here because this goes there. This state and this state are states of the field, so they go there. And since we are in the interaction picture, operators evolve with the free part of the Hamiltonian. So this is what we mean by Q0 there. While there we had Qt, meaning that this operator is time dependent. And what we finally get after this calculation is that that result over here. And the very good thing with this result is that we can actually see that this is the Fourier transform of this, this is the Fourier transform of this whole part here, along with the epsilon. So this is non-zero. If we have non-zero Fourier components of this whole part, which is actually trajectory dependent, it's something that you, if you plug in some particular trajectory of the detector, parameterized with the proper time, you can have some function here. And Fourier transform this function because it's like the exponential dt and take some result. And this is quite more general. It means that for general trajectories, you might detect particles in the sense that the detector will click. Even though you can generally not associate this with some particular temperature and I mean that, so this is what I mean by F trajectory over there. It's some time-dependent part that depends on the trajectory. Oh, there's some exponential missing. Yep, there should be an exponential over there. So the thing is that you can just plug in trajectories and of the detector and see if the if there is some non-zero probability for the detector to click or not. And you can check that if you plug in the trajectory of an inertial observer, indeed the probability is zero. I didn't include the calculation because it's quite long, but it's straightforward. You can just plug in a trajectory of constant velocity in the inertial frame of the observer and take that this probability is zero. And indeed, if you plug in the trajectory of a Riedler observer, the probability that you get is again, there's again some exponential missing over there because this is supposed to be like the Bose-Einstein factor, the Planck factor over there. Anyway, and you can again associate this probability distribution with this kind of temperature. So we get the same result as before, but we have gained some generality because, as I said, you can, I mean, these are just not all the possible trajectories you can try. And it's quite very, very special, these to vanish. I mean, most of the times you will get something non-zero. So this temperature that you can associate with the system in terms, in the case of a constant acceleration, we can see that when alpha is zero, when we don't have when the acceleration is zero, we have the zero temperature, which is associated with the vacuum of the field, in the sense that in the vacuum, we mean ground state, all oscillators in the ground state, no excitations, zero temperature, which makes some sense. And so let's draw some conclusions and some comments. So what we saw is that having some equilibrium between the constantly accelerated observer and the field in the vacuum state is the same as if the detector was not accelerated, but it was immersed in some thermal radiation, thermal bath in this characteristic under temperature. So the I also have to mention that the curved space-time analog of this thing is the Hawking radiation, because the constantly accelerated observer in flat space-time is equivalent to the static observer around some Schwarzschild black hole. So this is, again, the how we could somehow think of the Hawking radiation in this context. The second bullet is about the fact that this last way of taking this result was quite more general, and we can see that there are plenty of trajectories that give non-zero probability of excitation, even though you cannot necessarily speak about some thermal bath at a given temperature. So most of the times people think of Andre effect like the effect of perceiving some temperature when you're non-inertial. But it could not only have to do with perceiving some temperature, it has to do with detecting particles in that sense, and this is what the notion of detector was useful for, to generalize this result. And so comparing the two ways of getting the result, we might wonder about energy conservation, because in the first scenario, you just we just show the transformation, the transformation of the field mode, and argued that people might not agree to what they think about the excitations of the fields or what they interpret as particles. And this could also be associated with some thermal bath. But in the second scenario, you also have some oscillator, a detector being excited, plus the excitations of the field. So someone could argue that what happens with the energy, because you have both parts of the system being excited. The thing is that in this last scenario, we had the detector is an actual system that is accelerated, and this costs some energy. So you can, in some sense, attribute the excitation of the detector to this extra energy offered to the system by accelerating the detector into the field. Because the field provides some kind of friction, one could say, if we were talking about an electromagnetic field, for example, and our detector was some kind of atom with charge with electrons. There would be some, from the point of view of the inertial observer, while the accelerated charged particle emits some radiation, this would excite the field, and backwards, the atom would also be excited. So this is some kind of physical intuition we can have about that. So these are my references, and thank you for your attention.
Could you go back to your slide on UNRU effect?
Sorry, what?
The UNRU detector, did you use a harmonic oscillator or a qubit?
No, just some general system with some energy eigenstates. Epsilon zero. Sorry?
Have I seen interaction Hamiltonian?
Oh, so the way I wrote the interaction Hamiltonian was quite general, because I said we could just have some Q operator leaving the Hilbert space of the atom, which is our detector. This was the Q operator, coupled with the field itself, which is the field operator.
Yeah,
sorry.
Right.
So, yeah, here it is. So that's quite general. I mean, you just have some operator associated with the system. It could be for a two-level system that people usually use. It could be like the energy, like if the system is minus epsilon plus epsilon, two-level system, it could be minus epsilon sigma 1. I mean, sigma 1 operator that gives that. I mean, I've tried that. If you can try many different queues. But it's something associated, some operator, some physical quantity associated with the atom. Yeah.
So you're a first quantized system, which actually kind of already means that you're taking like a time direction, which you prefer and everything. But in fact, like if you would use an actual atom, an atom is still made out of like these quantum fields. So would that influence at all your calculation? Because you're.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a whole new treatment, right? Because. If you also want to describe each particle of the atom in terms of its field, you will have fields interacting with each other. So what people are trying to do there is just see the limits of the first quantization introduced into the second quantization and obtain some kind of intuition about notions that are getting not so clear in this context, like the notion of particle, vacuum, and all the stuff. So you don't, if you want to think of it this way, it would be much more complicated. I don't think it will you will gain any, you know, intuition or clearer results about this particular situation.
Because I would say like reason particles here because like you already have a first quantized system which already has like preferred, you know, kind of notion.
It's eigenstates.
Yeah, yeah. And if you would do like a second quantized system, then you're in the same situation, right? Where you can just like do whatever you feel and it's like always going to be Lorentz fair.
Also, yeah, I'm not sure what your comment is about, but you said something that since we introduce a first quantized system, we choose some time direction or something. So the only time that we choose that we don't really choose is like the proper time in the co-moving frame, which is the co-moving frame of the atom while it's moving. This is how we parameterize its trajectory in the inertial, the initial inertial frame. This is the only time we use here, the proper time of the detector. Yeah.
I have a question.
Yes.
Okay. Initially, we saw that the vacuum was dependent on these f's, right? Like if you change your choice of f, like the function in which you expanded.
The modes. Which in flat space time is just plane waves.
Yeah. So I was asking why? What gives you? I mean, why is? Why are those modes preferred? Like, how? If given some observer, how do you know what modes you want to choose?
So I would say that in flat space-time, it is the easiest thing you can do because if you just plug in some wave solution and you satisfy this dispersion relationship for omega and k, this is automatically solving the problem given that the operators that appear in the solution satisfy the other, you know, the usual commutation relation. I mean, the plane waves with this dispersion relationship is the most natural choice you can do in flat space-time, I guess. I cannot say something better than that. What? I'm not sure.
Some of the Cartesian coordinates have some close relationship with the Kirchhoff
flat space-time. They are eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So you can define your vacuum as the state which has the lowest energy, and it's the eigenstate of the Hamiltonian.
But for a different choice of F, there was some other vacuum, right?
Well, in general, you cannot do that. If you don't have, you know, Minkowski background, you cannot choose these eigenstates, the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. But it is modes to be eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. In the Minkowski space, you can do that, and that's why you have these preferred plane waves. There. And that reflects the fact that we have all the isometries of the Minkowski space there.
I want to say one more, that this dispersion relationship that this plane wave satisfy was crucial for us to be able to think of these excitations as particles, in the sense that we interpreted this omega squared as epsilon squared, this k squared as p squared plus m squared, and we said, it could be some particle of, even though when we have particular k, we're just talking about a plane wave. So I would just want to emphasize that this dispersion relationship is what makes us feel a little bit more confident in interpreting these field excitations as particles, as particle excitation.
So is there an application to this sort of idea?
So I mentioned Hawking radiation, which is like the most famous thing that is related to that phenomenon in flat space-time. I've heard that people are also interested in calculating these kind of things in arbitrarily curved spacetimes, in the sense that, okay, I claim that this, that's true, the constantly accelerated observer corresponds to a static observer outside a Schwarzschild black hole, but you could consider more strange scenarios in curved spacetime, like deforming, non-static situations in curved space-times, and try to calculate throughout the flat space analog what could you say? Because in flat space-time, we could kind of take this result, this more general result, quite easily. It was just some calculation for an arbitrary trajectory of the detector. So if you can do always this analogy with real curved space-time, it's something useful. Yeah, you can do.
Maybe, people sometimes argue that the Yang effect is just an effect of the fact that your observer is accelerated forever, that it comes from infinity at the speed of light and goes to infinity at the speed of light in the end. So, but it seems that your formula works for arbitrary trajectories.
Yeah, yeah.
So what happens if I switch on the acceleration for some time and then I switch it off again after some time?
Yeah, exactly. That's the nice thing about that. You can even program it and keep plugging in trajectories and see what comes out. I've tried like the simple things I could try, because the calculation gets quite complicated. You have to do some contour integrals and stuff. But generally, you can just plug in the trajectory and find the probability.
In this case, do you still get the thermal baths?
Yeah. No. I think, as far as I know, this analogy with some thermal bath is something that has to do with a constantly accelerated observer. As far as I know. Yeah, yeah.
Maria, one more question. You said that the lunar temperature only really makes sense for constantly accelerating observers.
Zero. I said something about zero acceleration.
No, the lunar temperature.
Yeah. Oh, that. Okay.
Now, if I'm not constantly accelerating, is there some way we can make it analogous to being in touch with a thermal bath at the temperature?
Locally, instantaneously or something. I'm not sure. I've thought about it, but I didn't really do that. Could be. The thing is, someone would say that constant acceleration provides the special geometry of the frame of the regular observer, so you can somehow obtain this state by tracing out this trait that I claimed it was thermal and do the identification and take the temperature. Generally, you cannot do that. You don't even know what to trace out, for a general motion. But yeah, it's something that you could, it's something interesting because it has to do with general.
All right, let's thank Maria again.